Morning. So this morning I'd like to talk about effort. This is my second talk on effort. This, for those of you who aren't staying here for a while, we're in retreat, and we have some of us are here for 2 days, some for five, some for seven, and I'm giving a whole bunch of talks. So my first two are on effort, which is the fifth. The sixth step in the Eightfold Path. The interior part of the path is what we're practicing here when we do meditation. The interior part, which is effort, mindfulness or bare awareness, and concentration. So those are that's what I'm talking about this week for those people who are practicing with me. Briefly review a couple things from yesterday. So effort in Buddhism the effort of becoming lights to ourselves. Each of us does it ourselves. Nobody else can do it for us. People can help us, but ultimately it's us. We've got to make a commitment to meditation practice, keep it going in good times and difficult times. It's totally up to us, and becoming a light to ourselves, by making this commitment ourselves and hanging with it, we become enlightened, which sounds like a huge fancy word, but really just means carrying ourselves with a little bit of levity, with a little bit of the worldly cares don't need to weigh us down, because we learn how to just live through our effort with grace, with balance, not grace and balance that is imposed by Tim or Ralph or Linda, but a natural grace and balance. So that's what this effort is about. And those people who are doing the long meditation with me, some of them are probably having problem controlling their thoughts, I would imagine. And even those of you who practiced this morning, maybe you had some trouble controlling your thoughts. And really, does anyone ever have control of their thoughts? Have you met someone who has control of their thoughts? Can the thoughts be controlled? Are they controllable? Are they ours to control? If we think they're ours to control, good luck. Good luck. So we bring ourselves back. We bring ourselves back to our meditation, to our moment. But abolish the thought that you will ever have control. Well, maybe you will for a little while, but that's rigid. That's not open. That's very transitory. Very transitory. So, in this practice, I've been talking the last few talks about the effort involves renunciation and openness. That's what it involves, renunciation and openness. And my example this morning, my first example, is from my grandson. I'm lucky to have two grandsons. Wow. Wow. This is my grandson who just turned 4 years old. And he had a party, and he lives in Paris, and he had a party. And he had, I think, 10 kids over. And my daughter said the party went well. I talked to him afterwards. He was talking so fast I couldn't understand him, but he was really excited. He was eating chocolate. His mother never gives him chocolate, but everybody brought chocolate to the party. The French really into chocolate. So he was Skyping with me and stuffing chocolate in his mouth. I said, "Did your mom know you're eating that?" He didn't say anything. So he had his party. And I said to Erin, "How did it go?" She said, "Oh, it went great." And I said, "And was he speaking French with the kids, the other kids?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, he was just there with them and just having a good time." And I said, "Oh." And the reason I said, "Oh," was that 2.5 months before, he didn't want to go to school. They have public school starting at 4 to 5 days a week in France. And he didn't want to go because, and the teacher said he was crying in class. And she said she didn't know why he was crying, but she wanted to talk to Erin about it. And they decided he was crying because he didn't speak French well enough. He couldn't understand the French. He couldn't keep up. Although he didn't say that. He just told his mama he didn't want to go to school anymore. He'd had enough school. 2 weeks is enough. Ever have that feeling? 2 weeks of Zazen is enough. 2 weeks of school, 2 weeks of whatever. He didn't want to go to school. And so his mama then went and talked to her husband, his dad, and talked to us, and what to do here, what to do. So they, well, you know, I think what they should have done, of course, this is me, right? They should have just spoken French when home. Jeez, my daughter knows how to speak French, but they don't do that. They just speak English, so what can I do? So my daughter said, he doesn't want to go to school, but I'm going to give him I'm going to coach him, and his teacher is going to come visit him. He likes his teacher, and then I'm going to promise him a new fire truck, a new red fire truck if he goes to school, because he doesn't have. He's got trains. He's got so many Thomas the Train. I've been just going to his house. So many different trains. That's all he cares about. No dolls, right? He's a guy, a guy 4-year-old, right? so he wants a fire truck. So the teacher came over to the house and she gave him a pep talk, and then Erin talked to him about the fire truck, so there was an agreement that he would go 4 days instead of 5. There's a 5th day, but where you go to a different teacher. So that was an agreement, and so he went to school, and so he went to school for those 2 months, and then he had this party, and at this party he was just hanging out with the kids, talking. I mean, not gabbing, but understanding them and being engaged and having a good time. And of course it was his own party. That helps, right? That helps a lot. And so I asked what went on. And the teacher said, Erin said, the teacher said she didn't know, but during that 2 months, he just, instead of playing with his cars in the classroom, he just sat and watched the kids. He was really not distracted. He was really focused. He was really attentive. Just watching. He had some investment. He wanted that truck, right? And also, he wanted to make friends with these kids. Nobody likes to be isolated and by themselves. So he was just watching. He was just paying attention. He was just focusing. Not playing with his cars at all. And not talking either. But just watching, just taking it in. So the birthday party comes, and the grandpa calls up and says, "Was it okay?" And Erin said, "Oh, sure." And I said, "Was it okay?" She said, "Yes, Ethan knows French." He was speaking French, and everybody was listening, and everybody was having a good time. Of course, the other kids were talking more. Of course, already he was probably on the threshold, and he just needed that 2 months of encouragement of what we call bare attention, right? Bare attention to go over the threshold. And you know, when we do this practice, it's not predictable. It seems like we're failing. When you try to learn a foreign language, it seems like you're failing for a long time if you really try it. I don't know how many of you have. If you're in a foreign country, you just feel like a total failure. I lived once in Guatemala with my wife, and I went to study Spanish in Guatemala. We weren't allowed to speak English. It was awful. After spending 6 hours with my tutor every day, one-to-one, just a young guy, young mind guy, I'd have perspiration all over my body just by trying to do it. But then at some point, it began to happen. It began to happen. That's our practice, you guys. This is our practice. I'm sorry that it's like this, but at the same time, I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry, because through your effort, you can experience great freedom, great joy. It's available. It's available. So, Ethan, he renounced staying home because he was going to get a truck. He renounced staying home. Once he had the truck in his mind, he was willing to go to school every morning. And he forgot even about the truck. You know, he got so engaged in being at school. And he was surprised when the truck came. That's pretty good. Pretty good practice, isn't it? I promise you, some deep composure, some wonderful openness through this practice. But I want you to forget all about it. Because when you're really engaged, you forget all about it. You will forget all about it. Because it's so close. So close. And the effort is just the effort, again and again, to come back to this. Leo Hansen has been gracing us this morning with a shakuhachi playing, which started in Zen monasteries, first in China and then moved to Japan. And I had a friend who was studying the shakuhachi, and for a long time he couldn't even make any noise at all. He thought, I should just go back to the flute. At least I can make noise with the flute. Screw this. But he had a very patient and loving teacher. And his teacher said, if you just do it, you just keep doing it, moment after moment, at some point, some noise will come out other than just your breath. And it might not seem beautiful at first, but it is very beautiful just when it comes out. So, renunciation and openness. We renounce and then we're open. Just renouncing, just getting himself to school was not enough. He had to just sit and watch. Just sit and be there. Just getting yourself to the Zendo, that's cool. You got yourself to the Zendo. You're here this morning. That's cool. And open. Just to this. Let the static come in too. Let that be part of your openness. Just let it pass through you. And in an effort, there needs to be this balance between renunciation and openness. If we didn't do any renunciation at all, we'd never sit in meditation. We'd just, watch TV or watch birds or do something, healthy or unhealthy. There has to be some renunciation. But then, don't let the inner critic take over the whole show. The inner critic then says, I haven't renounced enough. I need to renounce more. Maybe tomorrow or next day when I'm feeling better, I can renounce more. And the inner critic then beats up. Who does it beat up? Poor little you. Poor little you is beating up poor little you. So then, openness, just to whatever comes in. Just like the sponge that I've been talking about. It just lets the water flow through it. Doesn't notice whether the water is from the North Pacific or the South Pacific or the Arctic or the Antarctic, whether it's warm or cold, it just open. And that's how it stays alive, by being open. That's your real life, in this openness. Even if you die, you keep this openness, because it's not about the body. You can't control the body either any more than you control the mind. And sometimes we overdo the effort. We overdo the effort. We really want that truck. We don't want to wait for that truck. And sometimes, in some situations, we're just sort of lazy and zoned out and habitual. Habitual effort is not effort. If I just go through the motions, I know these motions pretty well now. Although I'm a very slow learner. I'm embarrassed at what a slow learner I am. But I know most of these motions pretty well in the Zendo. But if I just go through them on automatic, I'm not alive. Every time I lift my robe, there's a chance to just lift. Feel the lifting. Feel the air. Feel the flow. Every time. But I can do it as a habit. As a habit. And then I close down. That's not the life of a Buddha. That's not the life of a being. So we have to kind of come to a balance in our effort. Come to a balance. But there's no final balance that I got the balance. There's just a balance where we're more like the sponge. Or we just let the water flow through us, whether it's hot or cold or in between. And your mind will become quiet. Believe it or not, your mind will become quiet. Quieter and quieter. And you need to have a quiet surrounding for your mind to become quiet. So we are in, have a quiet surrounding. Until your mind is like a still pool. Like a still forest pool. And in that still forest pool, many strange beings still come. Many strange animals still come to that still forest pool. You think once you've got the still forest pool, you won't be visited. No. You still get all the visits, you guys. The animals still come and visit. Even the ones you don't want. Even the ones who are not your power animals, they come visit. Your nemesis animals come visit, as well as your power animals, to the pool. But the pool just stays calm. That's your nature. It just stays calm. It just stays still. That's your nature. So I was watching Larry King Live on TV, maybe 10 days ago or something. And he had the, I can't remember his name, he had this guy from Australia who collects exotic animals. And he has a menagerie. I hope, evidently he treats them well, but I don't see how he can do it. But anyway, any of you see this show that I'm talking about? Well, so Larry King's there. And so this fellow, this Australian fellow, is bringing the animals in one by one and putting them on the table in front of Larry King on the desk. You know how he has this big table? So these are really different kinds of animals. Like there's an African porcupine that's much bigger than porcupines that we know. Huge. And there's different snakes. And he brings in an eagle and an owl. And Larry King, who's quite garrulous, right? He gets very still. He gets very quiet. I've never seen this guy who is so adept at making conversation be so quiet. And he is very focused. Very focused. And of course, the fellow who brings the animals in is sort of chatting them up and chatting Larry up. And some of them are coming up to Larry, and then the monkey comes, actually sits on Larry's shoulder, and Larry's still very still, very still. And I thought, oh, even Larry King has the possibility of opening up to this. That's what I thought. That's what I thought. The situation is right. We can all open up to this wonderful, still Buddha nature. The Peace Pilgrim is a woman that I read a book about maybe 15 years ago. She did her effort. She did her effort, and she included renunciation and openness, both. And here's something about her and something quoted by her. You guys remember her. This is maybe 15 years ago, huh? She walked around the country for 20 years wearing her blue jogging suit that said Peace Pilgrim on it. Sounds kind of corny, right? You can be corny. You can be a corny bodhisattva. That's cool. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You don't have to be self-conscious. Blue jogging suit that said Peace Pilgrim on it, carrying a toothbrush. She spoke about peace, that you had to make yourself peaceful and the world peaceful. She never took food unless it was offered to her. She fasted otherwise. And she never took rides until much later in her life. She just walked around and talked about peace. And here's a quote from her. During my earlier spiritual growth period, the 10 years that she was getting prepared to do her peace walk, I desired to know and do God's will for me. Spiritual growth is not easily attained, you know, but it is well worth the effort. It takes time. Just as any growth takes time. One should rejoice at small gains and not be impatient, as impatience hampers growth. The path of gradual relinquishment of things hindering spiritual progress is a difficult path, but only when relinquishment is complete do the rewards really come fully. The path of quick relinquishment is an easy path, for it brings immediate blessings and then God. So that's the Peace Pilgrim. That's her encouragement. I haven't heard about her in years. She must be dead by now, huh? And my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, his comments on effort, which I have read in this Zendo probably 15 or 20 times, but here he is. Anyway, here he is. In order not to leave traces with your thought, when you do something, do it completely with your whole mind and body. Like a good bonfire, you should not be a smoky fire, but learn to burn yourself completely. Throw yourself wholly into whatever you do. And my story this morning is one I have not told in maybe a couple of years about that. So, about Suzuki Roshi. So, there was a woman in our sangha when I was young named Betty. And Betty had really bad depression. A member of our sangha who really suffered from her depression. And Betty was a concert pianist. And she, when she was really in her depressed funks, she couldn't do her concert pianist work. But she played tennis. And so one morning I saw Suzuki Roshi after something, maybe after breakfast. And I saw him with short pants on and a little sailor hat, a little white sailor hat. And of course he looked ridiculous, completely ridiculous, and tennis shoes. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm going to play tennis with Betty." And I said, "But you don't know how to play tennis." He said, "No, I don't know how to play tennis." I said, "And you're going to play with Betty?" He said, "Yes, I'm going to play with Betty." I said, "Do you mind if I tag along?" He said, "Oh, okay." So I don't remember exactly how I tagged along, but I do remember being there at the tennis court and Betty on one side and him on the other. And I remember Betty showing him how to hold the racket. And then I remember him hitting the ball to her a couple of times and falling down and looking completely ridiculous. and getting up and hitting the ball a couple more times and hitting it out of the court, down the hill, because we lived on a hill in San Francisco, way down the hill. And this kind of amusing escapade went on for maybe 20 minutes. 20 minutes of rapid-fire tennis between the Zen teacher and his and Betty Wong, his Chinese, wonderful Chinese student, who, when she wasn't depressed, was wonderful. And when she was depressed, was even more wonderful. Even more wonderful. So what about that? What about that? Well, there's his effort, right? There's his effort. I mean, what is that all about? There's some renunciation there. What's the renunciation? What's he renouncing? He's renouncing looking good, isn't he? He's renouncing being perfect, right? He's renouncing, I never should be a fool, because he was a fool. I mean, complete fool. Of course, nobody was watching him, so maybe if the whole sangha had been watching him. But actually, the whole sangha would have loved it. So, but if the Japanese people had been watching him, they would have thought, what's going on here? So renunciation and openness. He showed up at the tennis court. He hit that ball, man. He hit that ball. He may have hit it down the hill, but he hit it wholeheartedly. And it lasted for 20 minutes, the game. It was a short game. I don't know who won. I don't think there was any score kept. I think it was just a rally, if you could call it that. If you could call it that. So that's our effort. That's our effort. And Wutsu, a Chinese teacher, Wutsu says, right effort is learning to be the servant of another. To be the servant of another. And Wutsu said to his students in case 45 of the Gateless Gate, Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of another. Shakyamuni Buddha and Maitreya Buddha are servants of another. Tell me, who is that other? End of the case. End of the case. So who is that other? Who is that other? That other's not Buddha, not even God. Who is that other? That other is very close. Very, very close. So close that that's why it's not Buddha or God. Too close to be Buddha or God. Too close. So Wutsu, when he was practicing, when he was a fairly young man, he had spent a lot of time as a priest learning texts and ritual. Then he quit texts and ritual and just did zazen. I mean, I'd say he did it day and night, but he made his effort, meditative effort, the focus of his life. After he heard this comment from a teacher. It is like drinking water and knowing personally whether it is warm or cold. Knowing personally whether it is warm or cold. That's why we do this effort, so we can know this personally. Not through somebody else, personally. You know, when you just take that water in, immediately you know whether it's warm or cold. Immediate. No mediator. This is not about mediation. Most religion is about mediation. This is not about that. Ethan had no mediator in that class. No mediator. If he'd had a mediator, he wouldn't have sponged up the French. So our effort in meditation, those of us especially who are staying the rest of the day and staying even 5 days or 7 days, But those of you going home, too, when you do your meditation, it's in complete solitude, complete solitariness. That's the only way to discover this, because you become a light to yourself. You have to practice in solitude. You have to practice by yourself. You have to practice without depending on anyone or anything, so that you can really go into it, so that you can really discover that lightness. So Basho, I used to talk about Basho. I'll talk about Basho again right now. Basho, our Eiken Roshi has a very good book, which I gave a series of talks on a few years ago, on Basho, Basho's Haiku, which I recommend. Basho was a Zen practitioner, but he was not a priest. He was not a priest. He lived in the 18th century. He was not a priest, but he made his effort in a very serious manner. He renounced, and then he opened. He was a traveler. He wandered a lot as a poet, and so a lot of his meditation was walking meditation. He spent hours doing walking meditation, but not in a formal way. Just out in the country, like the Peace Pilgrim, really, like the Peace Pilgrim. And then he wrote his poetry as he journeyed with his zazen and his walking. And he practiced in complete solitariness much of the time, complete solitude. He was an extrovert. He liked people. But he knew that if he really wanted to imbibe this teaching, really wanted to get it in his flesh and marrow, he needed to practice in solitude. And so he wrote a poem, a haiku, "The morning glory, this too cannot be my friend." Pure friendlessness. We can't get anything from anyone. We want all this stuff from each other. We want to fill up the sponge, fill up our leaking holes. But we can't. We can't. We only get it for a little while, and then it's gone. Then it's gone. But at the same time, through this effort of renunciation and openness, something happens. There's a transformation that takes place. So he wrote this poem early in his life, "The Morning Glory, This Too Cannot Be My Friend," when he was really on a journey. He was really on a spiritual journey, just to do it all by himself. But then later in his life, he wrote, wake up, my friend, sleeping butterfly. wake up, my friend, sleeping butterfly. Pure friendlessness opens up to pure friendliness, total friendliness with everything, with everything, with everyone, with even those people who diss you, and not those parts of yourself who diss you. So in a way, in the latter part of his life, he had learned how to be a servant of another. And who is that other that he's a servant of? Who is it? Is there an answer to that question? If there's an answer, that's not the other that we're talking about, that we feel so close to us, closer than drinking nice cold water. So Wu Men, who is the grandson in the Dharma lineage, the grandson of Wutsu, the Dharma lineage, you know, transmission from teacher to student. You guys know about that stuff. Some of you know more about that than others. Once Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi were talking, and no, they weren't. Suzuki Roshi was talking, and Katagiri was listening. This is the way. Suzuki was the teacher. Katagiri just had to listen. You know, that's the way it goes. I'm sorry. Katagiri was the assistant teacher. Suzuki was the head teacher. Suzuki was talking, giving a talk, and he turned to Katagiri and he said, I wonder if Americans will ever understand what transmission is. So we think transmission is kind of getting your name on a piece of paper and being in a lineage and being a Dharma heir of someone. But really, transmission is becoming the servant of another. That's what it is. It doesn't have anything to do with transmission. Transmission is always happening. The butterflies are always lighting on our microphones. We may not see them, but they're here. They're in profusion. They're in profusion. And transmission is becoming a servant of another. That's transmission. So Wu Men, who's the grandson of Wu Tzu in the terms of the Dharma lineage, but don't take it too seriously. Oh, the great grandson. He says, through your effort, if you can see this other and distinguish him or her clearly, then it is like encountering your father at the crossroads. You will not need to ask somebody whether or not you are right. That close. Suzuki Roshi said toward the end of his life, when people see me today, when he said this, this is after I left him. He started to get famous after I left. I came to Minnesota and he started to get famous, and he got famous, and then he died of cancer. Almost immediately after he got really famous, he died of cancer. Anyway, he said toward the end of his life, when people see me today, they don't see the years I spent just doing zazen and being with my teacher. So I don't have any red trucks to give you. But I would promise you a red truck anyway, and I would do my best to try to create one if it would encourage you to practice. Maybe we could create one together. Because we have this great opportunity. We have this opportunity right now. Right now.